The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. This week, following Sunday's disastrous European election results, which left the Conservatives languishing in fifth place with only 9.1% of the vote, we've seen a multitude of seemingly masochistic candidates enter the race to replace Theresa May as leader of the party. Why? No one quite knows. Although the leadership candidates are so numerous that they could field their own football team, it's uncertain whether they'd be able to agree on what the rules of the game are, or indeed whether a goal is in fact a goal, or a goal in name only. Elsewhere, despite experiencing very different fortunes at the European elections, the Lib Dems will have a vacant leadership position soon as well, having gained 15 additional seats from their previous haul of a single seat in 2015. Vince Cable is stepping down from leading his party on the 23rd of July, as it enjoys a considerable resurgence. But who will take the reins? And just when we thought things couldn't get any more eventful, Donald Trump arrives for his state visit on Monday. I'm sure it's just what Theresa May was hoping for during her final week in 10 Downing Street. All of this coming up on this week's Politics Weekly. Now, let's start with the Tory leadership race. Following Theresa May's announcement on Friday that she'd be stepping down on the 7th of June, a long line of potential suitors have begun courting Conservative MPs, wooing them with hopes of unifying the party and succeeding where May had previously failed, in securing a favourable Brexit outcome, whether that's a deal, a no deal, or something else entirely. Boris Johnson is currently the frontrunner, and he's enormously popular amongst the party membership, but less so amongst Conservative MPs, who of course decide who makes it onto the members' final ballot runoff. Would MPs dare to thwart the membership's favourite? I'm joined to discuss all this by Martha Gill, the political journalist and former lobby correspondent, Sonia Soda, the chief leader writer at The Observer, and Will Tanner, the director of the Conservative think tank Onward and a former advisor to Theresa May. Hello all.
Hi.
Hi, Jess.
Will, you've worked with Theresa May. How did you feel about Friday's news that she'd set her date for a departure, and how will she be feeling about her legacy?
I was incredibly saddened to see Theresa stand outside Downing Street and announce her departure, but I do think that it was a long time coming, and she had clearly come to accept that that was her fate. I think the danger is that she leaves with a very unresolved Brexit situation, which is already dominating the leadership race. But I think ultimately she had tried three times. She hadn't succeeded. And while she was the candidate who in 2016 came to kind of calm a kind of gathering storm, she in the end succumbed to it. So I think I was sad, but she was clearly resigned to the result.
There might be that you end up with a sort of legacy for Theresa May, which is that her deal is the only one that's negotiated with the EU. And although we're getting a lot of a parade of leadership contenders, Dominic Raab, Jeremy Hunt saying that they'll renegotiate, in fact, we've had Michel Barnier say this morning even that the deal is not up for renegotiation. Do you think that could end up being her legacy?
I suspect if we do leave with a deal, and that is a big if at this stage, that it will be something very much like Theresa's deal. It's clear the EU has been through a difficult process. They've managed to keep themselves together during that process, which is no mean feat. And while there are some important details which Conservative MPs have trouble with, in particular the backstop, you can imagine something like the current withdrawal agreement getting through Parliament with some relatively small changes that will require the EU to open it up. But in the end, I suspect Theresa's legacy may well be negotiating a deal that comes 90% of the way towards the thing that Parliament finally accepts.
We're going to have to try and get through all these leadership contenders. There's quite a lot of them. We might miss some out. But let's start with Boris Johnson, who is probably still the front runner. Martha, he's actually been quite quiet recently. What's that tactic about?
I think he knows that it's his to lose. So the less he says, probably the better. That might be his tactic, although it has allowed some outsiders in the race who we never suspected to get all the attention to come through, such as Rory Stewart, who's hit on the device of going around places like Kew Garden, holding a phone and talking to the public like that. And he's sort of winning the race of Twitter, at least. Everyone's attention is on him. And people like Matt Hancock, who's also trying to and succeeding to attract attention by kind of standing up to Boris over business. So I'm not sure that it's working for him.
if you are someone who's very well known, someone like Boris Johnson, Sonia, then you don't really need to sort of carpet bomb the media, yeah. whereas there are the sort of the outsider candidates are more likely
yeah.
to do that.
And I think the other thing about Boris Johnson is that we know he's very gaffe prone. So I think I agree with Martha, the contest is his to lose, but the longer it goes on, the more chances that he sort of makes a cock up, essentially, that cost him the race. And we've seen him make all sorts of really bad gaffes before. We saw him have to withdraw from the leadership race last time when Michael Gove kind of stabbed him in the back. So I suspect his tactic, you know, where Boris Johnson's strength will come, I think, is if he makes it onto the top two, you know, when he goes out to the leadership. So his challenge isn't really getting himself well known amongst the media and proving himself in that sense, I think. It's getting enough MPs to back him so he goes on that ballot paper. And actually, his strategy on that is quite clear, I think. It's to try and build bridges with the moderate wing of the Tory party and say, look, you know, I might be quite hardline Eurosceptic. I'm not as bad as someone like Dominic Raab. And when it comes to domestic policy, I'm much more in your corner. I'm much more one nation conservative than someone like Dominic Raab, who's seen as much more kind of ideologically hardline on domestic policy. So I think that's his strategy, to sort of say to the moderates, there's going to be a hardline Eurosceptic on the ballot paper that goes to on the ballot that goes to members. The hardline Eurosceptic is probably going to win. I mean, they're almost certain to win because we know the Tory membership is much more to the right and much more Eurosceptic and much more in favour of no deal, a clean break Brexit than the population at large. So you should put someone like me on it instead of Dominic Raab. I think that's Boris Johnson's tactic.
Well, it seems like there's kind of two camps in this leadership race. There's the people who have quit, who are the real outsiders, who are going to present themselves as people who could rip up the deal and start again, people like Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, Esther McVeigh. And then you've also got the people who stayed loyal, the people who stayed inside the cabinet to try and make it work, Jeremy Hunt and Michael Gove and Rory Stewart, Matt Hancock. But obviously, there's two that go on the ballot eventually to Conservative members once they're whittled down by Conservative MPs. Do you think you end up with one of each camp, or do you think they end up sort of eating each other and you end up with two from one camp?
Well, one commentator the other day described it a bit like a Wimbledon match or a Wimbledon kind of series of successive matches where effectively both sides of the draw have a candidate who goes through the different routes and ends up in the final together. I think it is likely that we will have one from each camp in the final two, purely because I think there is quite a big battle for ideas at the heart of this leadership race. And I actually think on both sides, you have candidates who need to provide a lot more concrete plans to both MPs and the membership than they're currently doing. So, as you say, you have some people who are pushing quite heavily towards a kind of no deal, or at least ripping up the deal and starting again scenario. They haven't really yet set out how they will actually deliver no deal, given the fact that Parliament is quite clearly set against it and what the mechanism is to deliver no deal. And then you have, on the other side of the camp, a series of people who are broadly backing a deal, but they haven't yet set out how they will amend Theresa's deal or kind of change things like the backstop in order to make it acceptable to Parliament. And at the moment, those two things are kind of at odds. And I think the candidates that set out the most detail and come up with concrete plans will do the best.
I think that's really optimistic, actually, Will. I think one of the massive problems, actually, with this Tory leadership contest is it's an election. And it's an election in which people are speaking to just 120,000 Conservative members, not to the country at large. And personally, I just don't think there's going to be very much accountability at all in this election for people setting out detailed plans. I think the people who are going to do well with the membership are the ones who tack really to the right and say, hands up, you know, we just can't do this with the EU anymore. We want no deal. They don't have to set out any plans for how they're going to achieve it. And then I think the accountability, if there is any, will only come in after they've elected. So I think this is a terrible, terrible way for the country to be selecting our next Prime Minister.
But will they appeal to Conservative MPs, those people?
I think Conservative MPs have been incredibly irresponsible. We've seen that in the last few months. We've seen that from people like David Davis and Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab walking away from government, you know, not really prepared to say, yes, we appreciate that Brexit involves tough trade-offs. Instead, they've just been like, oh, this isn't for us. The government isn't doing what we want. We want this fantasy, really clean Brexit. They've been incredibly irresponsible. They're going to carry on being irresponsible during this Tory leadership contest.
Martha?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think this is where nuance will suddenly enter the conversation, because I think all the Tory MPs, certainly the ones I have spoken to, are very aware of what Sonia has been saying, which is that the membership is far more to the right. So they will be picking candidates very much with that in mind, which is why I think Boris's tactic and Gove's tactic, which is quite similar, which is to say, look, we need a true Brexiteer and we don't want a compromiser because this is not what the membership will vote for. But I'm the least worst option for you and I can bring some people together.
But isn't one of the other key things that this next Prime Minister needs to show is that there's someone who can reunify a splintering party and beat Jeremy Corbyn, someone who can reunify the country again? Isn't that a major thing for them?
I actually think that the more... absolutely, Jeremy Corbyn is preying on the minds of Tory MPs in this contest, but the other person who's really preying on the minds of Tory MPs is Nigel Farage. And so I think that's why in this contest we're going to see the party sort of tap right, because they're really worried about losing Conservative votes to the Brexit Party, not just in the European elections, but in a general election. So there's this very interesting dynamic going on. And I'm not sure there's anything that can... I think the Tory Party is so split at the moment. I'm not sure there's anything that's going to unify them. I think it's going to be a very tricky few months ahead for the Conservative Party.
I actually couldn't disagree with that more. I think that on the clear question of Brexit, obviously candidates are going to need to set out quite a clear plan for how they will deliver Brexit. It's clearly the most important thing facing the country and facing the party. But actually in the medium to long term, you've got other challenges. So you've got the clear challenge of how to win over younger generations and reach out to new groups of voters. We know that 50% of Conservative voters are now over the age of 65. That's an existential problem for the Conservative Party if it doesn't sort itself out. And we also know that the Conservative Party is losing the battle on economic ideas and the question of economic fairness. And so if it wants to get back its reputation for competence, for economic strength, and for making sure that things like wages rise and productivity rises over the long term, then they're going to have to set out some big, bold ideas. And I think that actually suits someone in the middle ground of British politics, someone who can win over new groups of voters, who can respond to public opinion in a meaningful way. It's clear that the British public are not in favour of big right-wing deregulatory ideas. They're in favour of broadly middle ground policies.
Well, I think if you had Conservative MPs selecting the next Prime Minister, perhaps that stuff, the long-term of the Conservative Party might be bearing on their minds. But the fact is, they're not the people who are ultimately going to select the next Tory Prime Minister. It's a right-wing, much older than average the general population, Conservative Party member electorate. And I think like so much of what's going on in the country at the moment, this Conservative leadership campaign, I think it's really optimistic, the sort of view you're setting out, that there's going to be this big battle of ideas. I think it's going to be absolutely dominated by Brexit, just like politics in the last 3 years in this country has been dominated by Brexit and other issues have completely fallen by the wayside. I don't see any reason why this Tory leadership contest would be any different.
I think that's right. And I think what people noticed, particularly in the last elections that we just had, is that people in the middle of the road are not unifiers. They're just ignored by both sides. And that's what's happening in the contest at the moment with someone like Jeremy Hunt, who is pleasing neither side. He's now saying that no deal would be political suicide, but before he's sort of been in favour of it. And so both sides on the broad split within the Tory party at the moment, which is those who want an out-and-out Brexiteer and those who are very worried about no deal, neither of them want to back him, and he's losing supporters, people like Gove and also like Rory Stewart on the other side. So I don't think unity is actually possible at the moment. Everything is very, very polarised. And if there is any unity, it will be one side making a practical decision that their favoured candidate cannot win. And so they're going to back someone who's not quite as bad as the worst candidate on the other side.
So the two things I would say in response to that are, firstly, at the moment there are about 188 MPs who are currently undeclared. 92 of them are Remainers, 66 of them are Leavers. The idea that that all of those Remainers will move over to a Brexiteer candidate, I think, is potentially wrong. They may split into different camps, but we know that Michael Gove and Jeremy Hunt have actually got the most MPs backing them at the moment, more than Boris Johnson. So the idea that it's inevitably a kind of no deal, hard Brexit candidate, I think is wrong. The numbers do not bear out.
But do you not
argument.
Think one of Sorry, them will get on the ballot paper?
So
that's all you
quite,
need.
Quite possibly. But then the other thing I would say is look at 2005. We were told the Conservative membership would elect David Davis. That David Davis was a surefire candidate to win the leadership election and to take on Tony Blair. That didn't happen. The Tory membership were far more moderate, far more keen on modernisation than anyone gave them credit for. And I think ultimately the Conservative Party as a whole, the membership, the volunteers, they are maligned in the media, but actually they are not hard right kind of bigoted people that some people say they are. They are hardworking, ordinary, often kind of working or lower middle class people in provincial England. They are not necessarily going to go for someone who is extreme in some sense. And that's not me saying any particular candidate is extreme, but I think lots of people assume that they are far more right-wing than they really are.
Just for the record, I didn't say bigoted. I think they are definitely more hardline Eurosceptic, though.
And among the people who will do the assuming are the Tory MPs who are selecting onto the ballot, and there's a narrative that they are much further to the right, and that's an important narrative to take stock of, even if we get surprised in the second round.
Who could we get surprised by? Who do you think is one of the sort of outsider candidates that might do unexpectedly well? Someone like Kit Malthouse, who's done this divisive kind of compromise, managed to bring Remainer and Brexiteer MPs together, even if the compromise didn't quite go anywhere? Or could it be someone who's sort of even more to the hardline right, like Esther McVeigh? Or if Steve Baker enters the race, could he do surprisingly well? What about someone like James Cleverly, the Tory vice chair, who's championing himself as the new generation? Is there someone who you think could break through?
Just on James Cleverly, I think he and Kit Morehouse are sort of going for the same kinds of votes, which is the sort of new, fresh face. But I think in that contest, James Cleverly probably wins because he's also just younger than Kit Malthouse. He's in his 50s and he's kind of able, I think he would win that particular one.
He's also been on the circuit a lot, obviously, as a Tory vice chair. He's been
That's true.
Around the Conservative associations giving speeches at practically every single one. So that might be something that's helpful. Any others that have caught your eye?
Firstly, it's interesting that there are so many candidates and that so many people think they stand a chance. That suggests that MPs are splintering quite heavily. But it's interesting the type of positions that people will take and the type of issues they'll try to raise. So Mark Harper is expected to enter the race. He will almost certainly make immigration a big part of his pitch. It's interesting that most of the candidates are very liberal on immigration and he is kind of very much in favour of controlled immigration. If you look at someone like Kit Malthouse, he's a housing minister. He will clearly make housing and the delivery of housing that he was part of when he was Deputy Mayor of London a big part of his pitch. So in many ways, I think the candidates will be interesting for the issues they put on the ballot paper, as it were, and the ways in which they differentiate this race away from Brexit onto the issues that people really care about.
Thanks all. Now, of course, the Tory leadership race has taken up most of the headlines this week, but it was only Sunday night when we got the results of the European elections where the Lib Dems experienced a remarkable resurgence in second position behind the Brexit Party. But with their leader Vince Cable announcing he will step down on July 23rd, what's next for them? So there are two candidates in the race, Ed Davey, the former Energy and Climate Change Minister, and Jo Swinson, who's the party's current deputy leader. Do we expect this race to tell us an awful lot about the direction of the Lib Dems, or are they kind of getting their success on the back of events?
I think very much on the back of events. And I think while they have done extraordinarily well in both the local council elections and the European elections, this may prove a relatively short-lived reprieve for the Lib Dems. It was just a few months ago that people were writing them off in the long term, and I don't think some of those risks have gone away. But what they're benefiting from is a kind of fragmenting of the different electoral coalitions on both left and right as a result of Brexit. So as soon as the Brexit issue is resolved, if it is resolved, and I am being optimistic again, then I suspect the Lib Dem resurgence will subside, and they will face a lot of the issues that they've always faced in the sense that they appeal to a relatively small proportion of the electorate and probably have a ceiling of about 60-70 seats.
Martha, what's the difference between the candidates? Is there one that will get in the other?
So Jo Swinson is the front runner and Ed Davey is coming up behind. He's going to try and close the gap. She's quite a long way ahead. I mean, this sometimes happens in Lib Dem races in 2015. Norman Lamb managed to close the gap quite a lot from being a bit far behind. The difference between them so far, because Ed Davey has just set out his stall, is that he's very much making a pitch for the green vote with his decarbonised business slogan.
Clearly a chunk of the pro-Remain vote that's going to the Greens as well.
Yes, which is not insignificant. And then Jo will differentiate herself from him by being more prepared to make pacts with the Greens. Lib Dems that I've spoken to sort of think that actually Ed Davey is onto the right tactic, because where the Lib Dems didn't stand against the Greens did really well. And so, in fact, giving them less air would be good for the Lib Dems. Normally, Lib Dem races are about, are the Lib Dems still relevant? Can they survive? And it might have been about whether Change UK would be a real threat, but both of those things, following their unexpectedly good performance, have gone away. I mean, the thing about the Lib Dems, I'm more optimistic than you, but I think they do... They're known for being great survivors, sort of cockroaches who can really, really survive. It's very bad to ever write them off because they will always surprise you and come back. But they're not very good at sort of seizing opportunities when they come. And we've been, sort of lots of people were expecting them to really seize the opportunity of, you know, the abandoned middle ground, the only party which is pro-Remain. And they still haven't quite done it. Perhaps they will.
It's a bit of a weird timing for a leadership election, isn't it? At the point where... you're kind of doing quite well and you thought there might be this big new challenge from a new party like Change UK, but actually that hasn't really proven to be
anything. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? Like, Vince Cable announced quite a long time ago that he'd be departing when their fortunes look quite different. And I suppose there's a question, would he still have said he was going to go, you know, at this point if he hadn't already said it? But at the same time, he has been leader for a really long time. And I do think they probably do need, you know, like it's time for a new face. I think what's interesting, though, is that both Jo Swinson and Ed Davey were, you know, quite senior members of the coalition. And it's interesting in Ed Davey's pitch today, he's really sort of defended the Lib Dems coalition record. Whereas Jo Swinson hasn't. And I think she's probably a bit less associated with that austerity politics. So I think one of the things that's going to sort of determine the Lib Dems' fortunes, it's partly circumstance and what happens with Brexit. I think Brexit's going to be around for the next 5 to 10 years. So I don't think it's a cleavage that's going to go away anytime soon in British politics. But I think a big question is, you know, they've clearly mopped up a lot of votes from Conservative Remainers and Labour Remainers. So what Labour does in the next few weeks will be key in determining whether they can keep up their vote share in a general election, which is always going to be more challenging than a European election where it's easier to cast a protest vote anyway. I'm a long-term Labour supporter. I didn't vote Labour. I voted for the Greens in the European elections. I wouldn't have voted for the Lib Dems purely because of their record on austerity in coalition. And so I do think there's a question, are they going to continue to defend their record in coalition? Ed Davey's line is very much, we softened what the Tories did, but actually some of the really expensive tax cuts that George Osborne and David Cameron delivered, the increase in the personal allowance, which disproportionately benefited more affluent families, was effectively paid for through cuts to tax credits and benefits, really regressive. That was a Lib Dem policy. So what Ed Davey says doesn't quite wash with me. So I think there is a bit that's about them and what they say about their record as well, and the extent to which they can dissociate themselves from that time in coalition and say, hey, we're something new now. And I think you're right that Jo Swinson may be more able to do that than Ed Davey.
There is that toxicity around the coalition, which we might thought might hang around the Lib Dems from Labour voters for longer than it has. But yet we're getting this kind of outpouring of expel me too after the expulsion of Alistair Campbell from the Labour Party for voting Lib Dem, where we're seeing loads and loads and loads of Labour members, not even Labour voters, saying that they had voted Lib Dem at the European elections. Well, do you think that vote is sticky, or do you think there was a protest and it'll just, they'll lend their vote to the Lib Dems in a one issue election like this, but in a general election that doesn't necessarily read over?
I suspect it's pretty short-lived, and these are people who are largely protesting against the current kind of obfuscation around, I mean, emergingly, kind of not obfuscation, but around the second referendum and Jeremy Corbyn kind of unwilling to kind of commit to a relatively specific Brexit policy. And I suspect lots of those Labour voters will go back. I mean, Lib Dem voters tend not to be very sticky anyway. They tend to move around quite a lot, and that coalition is quite difficult to hold together because it brings together some quite different groups of voters from different socioeconomic background. So I suspect it will be quite hard to sustain that over the long term, especially in general elections, as Sonia says, where a protest vote is much less likely.
Mother, if Labour makes a massive shift towards a second referendum, what difference would that make to the Lib Dems' fortunes? Because Jeremy Corbyn's kind of pushing at the door, saying that there'll be a referendum on any deal now rather than what he'd previously said, which was a damaging Tory Brexit. But he's not full-throatedly going out there leading people's vote marches. He's not doing what some of the Remainers in the party would like him to do.
No, Labour's got a problem, haven't they? Is that a lot of Labour votes come from Leave areas. So that is a perennial problem for them. And that's why they haven't gone full-throated for Remain, as well as the personal preferences of the leadership. So they might do that. And I do think that would take votes away from Lib Dems, of course, because as we've sort of all been saying, Brexit is dominating politics at the moment. That is the issue which will decide people's votes mostly. And so, yes, if Labour moves to Remain, that will recapture their votes to Lib Dems. But I don't know if they're going to do that. And Brexit is going to continue to dominate. And so we can't just say, oh, people are joining the Lib Dems because of Brexit, and so therefore it's not going to stick, because I think the issue of Brexit is obviously here to stay. So we've got to look at the environment in that context.
Do you think people in Labour HQ are going to be sort of sufficiently spooked by this, you know, the Lib Dems willing Islington, to want to change their strategy, which is to try and appeal to both sides of the divide?
I hope so, because I think what the European election results showed was that a prevarication strategy isn't really working for Labour anymore. It's not really kind of landing with either type of voter, whether you're a Labour Leave voter or a Labour Remain voter. No one really looks at the party's position and thinks, oh, great, yeah, they're a party that's going to deliver Brexit, so I'm going to keep voting for them, or they're a party that's now a Remain party in support of a referendum. And I think, you know, the prevarication strategy, to be fair to Labour, did work for quite a while in holding this voting coalition together. It just has stopped working. And I think the tricky thing for Labour is that whichever way, you know, it's, I think on a matter, as a matter of principle, it's got to be upfront with voters about what it stands for. It's not really fair to voters to try and be all things to all voters. It's the most important question facing the country in decades. Labour's got to say what it stands for, whether it is for a soft Brexit or whether it's for a referendum in which it would campaign for Remain. And Jeremy Corbyn, I mean, Labour still isn't a Remain party. It still hasn't said that, and you know, while it hasn't, the Lib Dems will continue to do well. Whether it will be enough pressure, I mean, I think pressure is increasing, and that's why we're seeing Jeremy Corbyn edge, you know, every sort of week ever more slightly towards Labour becoming more out and out a party of Remain. But the fact of the matter is, and I think this is really important and it's difficult to underestimate, is Jeremy Corbyn is at heart a Eurosceptic. He doesn't really want to campaign for Remain in a referendum, I think. So I think that is what's holding Labour back. And I think if you had a leader who didn't have that quite deep-seated scepticism of Jeremy Corbyn, I suspect the party would have already shifted.
It wasn't quite clear whether it was Labour's lack of clarity on their position or whether it was Labour's actual position which was the problem. Is it because they are in the middle of the road, or is it because they weren't clear about the details? And the danger is, and I think it's both, and importantly because they're in the middle of the road as well, but there's a danger that Labour will interpret it as, we just need to set out more coherently what our soft Brexit middle of the road position is to everyone, and then they will understand and vote for us.
Yeah, Emily Thornberry, I think, said that it took 5 minutes on the doorstep to explain what Labour's policy was, whereas for the Lib Dems, it took them less than half a second to explain what their policy are. And does it ever work for, you know, Labour sources will point out the slight change in language of Jeremy Corbyn's statements since before the elections. But does that ever work with voters?
No.
Do voters ever pick up on those sorts of nuances?
You know, voters, like we in Westminster sort of track very closely what politicians say and detect a slight edging in the position. Of course, voters aren't there kind of doing discourse analysis on Jeremy Corbyn's like press statements and what he's saying on a referendum. Like, voters need a really, really crisp soundbite, and Labour hasn't got one yet. And that is just a basic fact. You know, it comes back to what Emily Thornberry said. So, you know, I just think it's got to come out more firmly and either say we are a party of soft Brexit, which I don't think is going to win it many votes in many corners, because I don't think that lands particularly well with, you know, Leave voters or whether it's Remain voters, or it's got to say we're a referendum party and we'll be campaigning for Remain in a referendum.
It's odd though that we kind of lament the nuance and we lament the polarisation and the fact that we can't have a sensible compromise solution, and then we criticise Labour for trying to sort of work towards that, for not being able to sell it.
It's not a compromise, though. It's
no.
a fudge.
Exactly.
It's deliberately
That's
misleading.
I completely agree with Will.
And I think the kind of continued obfuscation and prevarication strategy that Sonia talked about is a real problem for the Labour Party, because it doesn't. Right. It's not just that it's unclear; it's that they look dishonest.
Yeah.
And the longer it goes on, the more dishonest they look.
Fundamentally.
And the reality is the reason why Nigel Farage did very well is he looked like an honest politician. Whether you agreed with him or not, he was standing up saying something that was very clear, that was very easy to understand, and you could tell that he believed it. And for the last 2 years, we've had lots of politicians who haven't done that. Mm-hmm. And I think the politicians that now do that, whether that's in favour of no deal, whether that's in favour of revoke, whether that's in favour of second referendum, will do far better than those that try and sit on the fence. We've dealt with this issue so badly for 2 years, we actually just now need to get on and do it in one way or another.
But that is a problem for anyone who is anywhere other than Leave with no deal or Remain, which are very easy to say simply. anything else is
hard. Isn't that basically where the country is now? I mean, I was talking to Rory Stewart earlier this week, where he said one of the things that really struck him is that he's meeting people now who, you know, they leave there for no deal. And there are people who are not even for a referendum anymore. They just want to revoke Article 50 and stop Brexit. And some of those people, you know, shortly after the referendum, and particularly Remainers, would have like taken a sort of sensible Brexit, soft Brexit deal, and thought they wanted to just deliver the result of the referendum in a way that minimised the economic impact of it. And now they just want to revoke Article 50, and that's where we've got to now.
The reason for that is that it's really, you know, we've had 3 years, that compromise hasn't been reached. It's been shown that it's really difficult to get that sort of compromise through Parliament. And I think if you're on the Remainer side, if soft Brexit, if, you know, if first of all, the terms have changed. So what used to be, a soft Brexit used to be basically staying in the single market and customs union. And to be honest, there are lots of Remainers who would probably accept that if that was guaranteed to be the status quo. But people like Nigel Farage are going to look at that sort of compromise solution and say it's a betrayal of the people and a betrayal of the referendum result. So the idea that Britain leaves under a soft Brexit deal and then that is how we live our lives for the next 10 years, I think is a bit kind of, you know, it's a bit of a fantasy. So I think there's a question of the extent to which a compromised Brexit actually exists to some extent.
No, it certainly doesn't in the terms of what you can sell to the public and what the MPs want now. But that is, it is slightly to be regretted, is what I'm saying, that we have moved to that point where you cannot come up with an alternative solution which involves more than 3 words to sell to the public.
The missing ingredient is leadership. It's not, this isn't that we've kind of had our debate divided into two extremes. It's the fact that actually no one's been selling the compromise very effectively. And I think that's true of everyone in the middle of ground, actually, whether you're in the cabinet or not. And I think actually what Rory Stewart's doing is very interesting, because he is going and selling and kind of making an argument for effectively a compromise. He's ruling out both the extremes and saying, I will get something done in the middle. And he's having an amazing response. The interesting thing is actually the extent to which people can sell that during this leadership race and then immediately afterwards, because I suspect we probably will end up with some form of compromise. It doesn't really work to do politics just to one side or the other. So the question is one of leadership rather than one of extremes, I would say.
Okay, thanks all. We'll be back after the break to discuss the imminent Trump state visit. Welcome back. As if things weren't tumultuous enough with Brexit, European elections and multiple leadership races, next week Donald Trump is due to touch down in the UK for a state visit. Following a recent visit to Japan that involved golf, burgers and sumo wrestling, Trump will arrive in the UK bringing his wife, all 4 adult children and their spouses. Theresa May will be in her final week as Prime Minister, and with the arrival of a new Conservative leader still weeks away, how might Trump keep himself busy on his visit? I'm joined by Sarah Elliott of Republicans Overseas UK to discuss. So, Sarah, what do you think that Trump will be looking to get from this visit to the UK?
Yeah, well, I think he's looking to actually, press reset on a free trade agreement, a possible free trade agreement with the UK. Last summer when he came, he really wanted to embrace Theresa May in the UK and help her in her EU negotiations by saying, you know, they have alternative trading arrangements, but her Chequers deal did not allow him to do that. So I think now that there's, she's on the way out, there's someone new coming in, I think the Americans are very eager to start that process again, if possible.
And so the political turmoil in the UK, that's not something that's necessarily seen as a negative for him coming over. It's actually the changeover might be helpful.
Yes. That's a really good point. I think the Americans see it as a reset button. I think they're very... they're very eager for a Brexiteer to come into the role. This administration is very much in favor of Brexiting because it'll enable them to do more with America if they are able to leave the European Union. So I think they see this as a great opportunity, actually.
In terms of like concrete achievements at this visit, it is a reset moment, but that will probably come when there's a new prime minister, right? It looks like there's probably little concrete that you can actually get out of this visit.
The Americans have put forward ideas. And of course, Liam Fox, who's the Secretary for International Trade, has been over to the US multiple times. You know, this enables them to, you know, on a diplomatic front, set the tone. and the relations for the next prime minister when they step in to just hit the ground running. And it's a way that America, as these state visits are, for each side to put forward their desires, their plans for a better relationship. And that's what the Americans are doing here. Does the president also want to have his picture with the queen and have his entire family meet the royals? Yes. Perk of the job. You know, he's able to do that. And he's a big Anglophile. His mother's Scottish. He has Scottish business. I think it can only be a positive for our countries at the end of the day.
So it's the kind of the visuals of him with the royals, the picture of that special relationship, which is the main goal out of this particular visit.
I don't think it's the main goal, but I think it does, you know, pictures and visits are very symbolic. And I think it continues to show that even 75 years on after the big conflict that forged the special relationship, World War II, that we still very much care about the relationship. And it shows that the last three presidents have received state visits. And that's, I think that's really important, that this Anglo-American alliance remains strong and that it shows that there's a desire on both sides for it to remain strong. And, you know, I always say that regardless of president or prime minister, our countries are intrinsically linked. You know, history, values, challenges, economics. And it's really good for both countries, regardless of who's leading it, leading both countries, that we continue these diplomatic missions.
Trump isn't necessarily known for his diplomacy on these visits. And would you expect him to endorse one of the Tory leadership candidates potentially?
There's always that potential. he's going to be unpredictable. He likes being unpredictable. My hope is that he doesn't, because no one likes a foreign leader to intervene in an election. You know, the UK did not appreciate it when Barack Obama said the UK is now back of the queue during the referendum. I think that was a backlash, and it helped the Leave argument. So I hope he doesn't. I know that he's quite fond of Boris Johnson. I think that's the only contender he's met or has a relationship with, but we shall see. I also think he will be gracious to Theresa May, as this is her last week in office. And he has said some nice things about her when she announced the resignation. So, you know, I hope it remains a positive. It will be unpredictable. But again, it's an opportunity for America and the UK to, you know, talk again about ways of being economically connected, even more so in a post-Brexit world, as Britain leaves the EU, and how can that alliance be strengthened even more?
Thanks, Sarah. I'm joined once again by Martha Gill, Sonia Soder and Will Tanner. So Will, do you think there are things that Theresa May would rather be doing in this coming week, or is it a useful distraction?
Well, look, she's still Prime Minister and she's going to undertake the state visit in the same way as she would, and crucially go over to Normandy and do the D-Day commemoration. So I think she was always clear that she wanted to effectively stay on to do those things and to ensure that she was representing the United Kingdom in that regard. But I'm sure she will feel happy that she is not kind of directly involved in the fracas that is the Tory leadership race, though.
If Trump endorses a Tory leadership candidate, and I think we can only think of one that he might, there's probably only one that he's really got a relationship with, which is Boris Johnson. Is that a help or a hindrance?
It's difficult to say. I mean, definitely the Farageists amongst those who will select our next prime minister, it might appeal to them, because Farage, of course, has the strongest affiliation with the type of politics Donald Trump has. I don't think it'll do him any harm, actually. I think it will just sort of concentrate the loyalty amongst a particular group, and everybody else will kind of dismiss it.
Do you think we might not get that reaction that, you know, it didn't particularly go down well when Obama came over and said, you know, back of the queue and started talking about the Brexit debate? And Donald Trump interfering, if you like, in the Tory leadership race, do you think that could backfire?
I don't think it will be particularly popular amongst the public at large. I don't think Trump is particularly popular amongst the British electorate at large. But we are talking about 120,000 Tory members here who are going to be selecting Boris. And I kind of agree with Martha. I mean, it's very hard to know because we actually don't know what the views of those 120,000 people are on Donald Trump. And it kind of does depend on that. But I can't imagine it will do him too much harm. But I think, you know, there'll be a lot of general debate about Trump and whether Trump should be interfering. And I think the general consensus across the British public and certainly across, you know, pundits may well be, you know, he shouldn't be sticking his nose in. But whether that will do Boris Johnson any damage with the people who really count, which is the people who are going to be selecting between the top two, assuming Boris Johnson gets to the top two, I kind of agree with Martha.
I think the more interesting question is what he says about a future free trade deal with the US. I mean, he could make some quite important statements about the type of relationship he sees the UK having post-Brexit and the type of relationship with the EU that would be needed to necessitate that. So actually, in substance terms, in terms of policy, he could be very important. And we have to be realistic that this is a major trading partner for the UK and our largest security partner. This is, I mean, we are in the process, the Conservative Party is in the process of electing someone who is going to be having phone calls about national security matters with this man. So I think it is an important visit and it will set the context for some of the leadership race. But whether or not he interferes is a different question.
Yeah, I think one of the things we know about Trump is to take stuff that he says with a pinch of salt, though. He's not especially reliable in promises and pledges that he makes. And the other thing that I think that is very worried for Britain in this position in which it stands, where who knows where we're going to be in a year, but we may possibly be out of the European Union, much more reliant on America as a trading partner, is that, you know, Trump does what he says his policy is, which is America first. And he will absolutely be putting America first in any potential trade deal with the UK. And so this idea that we're not going to be a rule taker anymore if we leave the EU, we will be more of a rule taker under a free trade agreement with the US. It's a much bigger economy than ours. And it will be able to set standards on stuff like food. So we should be prepared to say hello to chlorinated chicken.
Last question, but we're not going to see very much fundamental, concrete achievements out of this visit, are we? It's very difficult for that sort of thing to be signed off with a new Prime Minister. But I suspect you're right, Will, that the Tory leadership candidate will be looking for signals from him about the future. And that's the most concrete thing we can hope to take from this.
Yes, absolutely. I think there will be some form of announcements or at least indications about the relationship between the US and the UK over the slightly medium to long term. And clearly, President Trump is president. He controls the machinery of the US government. And that will be important for UK policy in a variety of different ways, whether that's on the economy, whether that's on security. But actually, more importantly, it will set the context also for the future relationship or renegotiation with the EU. If a new leader does come in and wants to renegotiate, actually having a US president effectively saying he will back the UK in that will give the UK potentially more leverage in that renegotiation. So it's really important context. We shouldn't dismiss it as just a parade of the US president coming to London. It is actually very, very important for our politics. And we should take it seriously. We should take Trump seriously.
Thanks very much, all. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Sarah Elliott, Martha Gill, Sonia Soda and Will Tanner. The producer was David O'Donnell. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.